I assure you, by that point, I would have been more than happy never to have any contact with Chimpan Ali again. Fate, however, had other plans, as it so often does. Visitors to House Bayou were not all that common, but not all that infrequent either. So on one particular day, when the air was a bit crisper than usual, I thought nothing of it at first when I noticed three horsemen approaching from a distance. At that moment, I was busy working with some of the young boys in the village. Several of them possessed small practice swords created from bamboo. Granted, I was hardly the greatest swordsman who ever lived, but I knew the basics. I'd done a long day's work in the fields, and my leg was throbbing. Nevertheless, when I limped back to the village, there were some of the youngsters waving their bamboo swords and looking to me hopefully. I had made quite an impression on the youngsters when I'd first arrived, or rather, the sword strapped my back had. Clearly, they'd never seen anything quite like it. They knew of swords, but claimed the swords of the Chimpan were very different from what I carried with me. I took their word for it, considering no one else in House Bayou appeared to own a weapon. I had learned that the type of digging tool they carried was called the Sai. When I eventually learned their language, I had spoken with Double Chin about the misunderstanding involving their wielding of their farm implements upon meeting me.
I thought your Sai was a weapon. You know, it could be used as such.
A weapon? A tool designed to create life from the dirt, used instead to take life and place people beneath the dirt? Not possible.
Very possible. Why, if used properly as a means of extending one's reach, it could be as devastating as a sword.
No, my friend. A sword is just a sword, while a sai is just a sai.
And that was where we left it. The youth of House Bayou, however, had their imaginations fired by my sword and had taken to asking me for pointers as to how to wield one. This had earned me a great deal of scowling and disapproval from Taegon Chin and Clef Chin, but the enthusiasm of the young men could not be denied, and so it was that the village was occasionally filled with the sounds of bamboo swords clattering against one another. The boys were quick studies. I was able to teach them a number of basic blocks and guards in a very short order, and within a month or so, their wielding of the bamboo practice swords was so deft that I was hard-pressed to touch some of the more able students at all. Granted, there were limits as to what I could do, thanks to my lame leg. But that didn't take away from their basic ability, and I like to think that I had some facility as a teacher. So there we were, in the village, sparring, as was our wont, when the riders appeared. The boys grew very quiet as the horsemen approached. They did not seem particularly concerned, but the banter and sense of fun we'd been having dissipated. I quickly saw why. The horsemen all had swords with them. None of them, strangely enough, had scabbards dangling from belts. Instead, they had very wide cloth belts around their waists, and the swords were shoved through the belts and held in place against their bodies. Even though the swords were sheathed, I could tell they were very different from my own bastard sword. They were very slender, for one thing. It seemed to me that made their swords vulnerable to breaking should they come into contact with my own. On the other hand, if they were smaller and lighter, the wielders might be able to deftly maneuver past my own larger and slower blade, cutting me to pieces while I was still trying to bring my weapon around for a blow. Not that I was either expecting or anticipating a battle. True, I had developed a most uncharacteristic affection for these people, but I had not lost sight of the fact that I was still apropos. My safety came above concern for the safety of others, and I had no intention of laying my life upon the line for anyone. Still, occasionally, I did indeed find myself in do-or-die situations. In such instances, I always elected to do. The problem was, my actual blade, not the practice sword I was using in jousting with the lads, lay in my hut out of reach. My staff was at hand, as always, and was a ubiquitous weapon, but still not quite as devastating as my sword. And I had the sai in my belt. My conversations with Double Chin came back to me at that moment, and I was damn glad that I had conceived of ways to use the implement as a weapon if need be. Others of the village were emerging from their huts, and in short order, the entirety of the village was gathering in its small dirt streets. They were speaking rapidly to one another. The problem was that my comprehension of their lingo depended upon slow, careful enunciation. If they were addressing one another with any sort of genuine speed, I was hopelessly lost. I could pick out words here and there, perhaps even pass a sentence or two. Nothing beyond that, however. I knew in time I would comprehend more. Unfortunately, I had the uneasy feeling that these horsemen were bound and determined to provide us as little time as possible. They reined up, looking upon the gathering throng with unveiled contempt. By that point, I was wearing one of their own hats, those very wide-brimmed bamboo head coverings that served to obscure much of my face if I had it angled forward. Their clothing bore no resemblance to that of the farmers. They sported robes with large flowing sleeves and intricate woven designs of red and gold. Their breeches were likewise loose and flowing, gathered in at the waist through the huge belt and tapering down into black boots. Dragons seemed to be the predominant visual image upon their clothes, stitched in a variety of manners. They had stylized haircuts, their hair pulled back tightly into top knots, leaving them with very high foreheads that glistened in the sun. The center one rode forward a step.
Attention, people of...
Then he stopped and stared at me. I lowered my head a bit, hoping to divert his scrutiny. It didn't work.
What is wrong with your face?
I didn't see where responding was going to be of much benefit. Instead, I just shrugged in a vague manner. Unfortunately, Kitchenette chose that exact time to wander past, and she had apparently been taught always to respond when asked a question by one's elders.
That's Paul. He's not from around here.
I fired her my fiercest look. She smiled back innocently. What a sweet child. Would that she had been within range so that I could have hugged her, or even better, staved in her head with my staff.
Oh, really?
The horseman swung his leg over his mouth and dropped to the ground. He swaggered toward me, his thumbs hooked into his sash. It gives me a chance to inspect his sword closer up. The hilt was white, ivory, unless I missed my guess. It was ornately carved with images of dragons upon it.
And whereabouts might you be from?
Here and there.
I see. And where precisely is there?
When I didn't respond, he swung his arm in a wide arc and knocked the hat from my head. Then he gripped my chin and turned my face this way and that, inspecting me as he would a horse.
I have never seen anything like you.
Unfortunately, I had seen his type all too many times in my life. I refrained from saying so, however. It was interesting. I felt as if part of me was stepping outside of myself. Once upon a time, my fundamental cravenness and weakness of spirit would have filled me with fear over what was going to happen next. But something was different this time. Perhaps it was all the time that I'd spent as the Peace Lord of Wuin, seeing people bowing and scraping before me. Instead of fear, I was feeling mounting anger, and I quickly realized why. It was because all this time, I had been wondering and dreading when something would go terribly wrong with the bucolic turn my life had taken. And now that it was here, now that the possible destruction of my newfound existence was upon me, all I could fear was slowly building fury that I had been right. The cynic in me rejoiced, but a budding optimistic side hadn't wanted to be right.
What do you want?
It was Take-On Chin who had spoken, with Cleft Chin right next to him, and Double Chin nearby. Cleft Chin was no more a fighter than anyone else in the village, but he was burlier than the others, and cut an imposing figure when he simply stood still and glowered. He had exceptional glowering skills. Unfortunately, his fighting skills were almost non-existent. I'd watched him spar with the boys on a couple of occasions, and felt confident in saying that Kitchenette could have disposed of him with alacrity. I had to admit, though, Take-On Chin, for all that he annoyed me with his perpetual scowls, wasn't backing down in the face of the newcomer's swaggering attitude. The newcomer looked him up and down.
Do you know who I am?
Should I?
I am Kaby of the Skanky family. You know the Skanky, I take it?
I know of them. They are reputed to be a business concern, are they not?
Do not toy with me. You know the power and influence wielded by the Skanky.
They are criminals. You all are.
An honest man.
We are all honest men here, you will find. We live in peace. If you come in peace, you will be received as such.
I come in earnest, is what I come in.
He began to walk in a wide circle, hands behind his back. A distinct swagger to his stride that was typical of the thuggish mindset such features possessed.
Thus far, the Skanky family has limited its influence to the major cities. We have decided, however, to branch out. For the solidarity and good of all, it seems the reasonable thing to do, and it will be to your benefits as well.
Our benefit? How is the interest of the Skanky to our benefit? We are simple farmers here. We have no involvement in the activities of the Skanky or their influence in cities, major or minor.
That will change. Your village will offer up tribute to the Skanky family. Half of what you harvest will become property of the Skanky, to do with as we wish. Silence! Silence! Obviously, you believe that you will be getting nothing for your contribution to the Skanky. That is not at all the case. You will be receiving protection.
Protection? From what?
From them. If you do what they say, you won't wake up one morning to discover the burning of your crops, or your homes, or yourself.
You have a firm understanding of business.
We won't stand for it.
I see. And do you speak for all in this village? All the men? The women?
His gaze settled on Kitchenette, who was watching him with rapt fascination.
The children?
In a flash, his sword was from its scabbard, and I could see instantly that the edge was lean and razor sharp. So sharp, in fact, that it would likely make short work of my staff. Even as he brought the sword whipping around toward Kitchenette, even as the people cried out as one, even as my mind screamed, "What the hell do you think you're doing?" I stepped into the path of the blade with a sigh, yanked from my belt. I brought it up as I would a dagger, thrusting outward in desperation as much as anything else. But sheer dumb luck was on my side, fortune favoring the foolish, and I intercepted the blade between the middle prong and one of the upraised sides. I stepped forward, bringing me chest to chest with KB, twisting my wrist so the sword was angled to one side, away from us, locked into the hold of the simple farming implement. Sometimes a sigh isn't just a sigh. I twisted my wrist as hard as I could. The blade was remarkably flexible, I'll give it that. But the pressure was unexpected and at an extremely odd angle, and the sword simply wasn't built to endure it. The stunned KB was abruptly standing there, holding a hilt with about half an inch of steel extending from it. The rest was lying on the ground, looking like a severed head lonesome for its body.
She done!
I do not know what he said, probably because the residents of Hounds by You were far too polite to have taught it to me. I had no time to rejoice in my minor victory, however. Because KB shoved me square in the chest. I tumbled to the ground. I came up quickly, though, still gripping my staff as he advanced on me, discarding the hilt and whipping out a dagger from hiding.
What my ought near?
I didn't wait for him to draw near. Instead, I thrust the base of my staff forward, catching him squarely in the pit of the stomach. Would that I'd had the other end in position, because I would have popped out my blade and disemboweled the bastard. As it was, he staggered back, holding his gut and looking distinctly pale. But matters were rapidly spiraling out of control, for the other two men had bolted from their horses, and they had their own swords out. Idiot, this is what you get for taking chances on the behalf of others, my inner voice informed me with obvious contempt. I'm quit of you. You're on your own, for the few seconds of life you have left. I had the scythe still poised in one hand, the staff ready in the other as I hauled myself to my feet. Would that I'd had my sword.
Stop!
You'd have thought that a single voice wouldn't have any impact on such as those outlaws, but something about it absolutely commanded attention. Chimpan Ali had emerged from his hut. He was eyeing them thoughtfully, and he wore his calm like a comfortable cloak. He gestured towards his hut.
Come, let us talk.
This one must die!
And he will, as all men must. There is no need for you to hasten it.
Oh, but there's very much a need.
Then kill him later. He's not going anywhere. Share the hospitality of my hut. We will discuss matters and come to an understanding.
Are you in charge of this rat trap?
KB wasn't taking his eyes off of me, but he did take a sidelong glance in Ali's direction.
I am the village elder. That has always been sufficient. Now come, please. Humor an old man.
Very well. Let this one dwell for a time on the fate that awaits him.
He headed for the hut. His companions fell into step behind him. The villagers started to crowd toward me, obviously to thank me for my bravery and derring-do in the face of adversity.
It was nothing, nothing.
I headed for my hut as fast as I could. Why? To get the hell out of town was why. I had no intention of hanging about and waiting for those brutes to saunter out of our lease hut so they could continue where they had left off and lay waste to me. What was problematic, of course, was determining how best to avoid my would-be killers. I couldn't just hit the road. They'd catch up with me in short order. I contemplated stealing their horses, but I couldn't be sure that would work. The animals might be too well trained to allow a stranger to ride them, and I certainly didn't need to have them hear a bucking and whinnying horse tossing me off its back so that they could run out and dispatch me quickly. My mind racing, I decided the best thing to do would be to head for the wheat fields. The stalks were tall and concealing, the fields fairly vast, and the odds of them managing to locate me if I didn't crash around in them too much were relatively slim. At least that was what I told myself. Granted, there was every possibility that upon finding me gone, the brigands would take out their hostility upon the villagers. I felt badly about that, which was something of an accomplishment for me. There were footsteps at my door, and my shoulders tensed in anticipation of a sword blade winging toward me. But before I could yank my sword from its scabbard in a last-ditch attempt to save my life, Double Chin entered.
That was very brave of you.
Thanks.
What are you doing?
Reorganizing.
Odd. To the dispassionate observer, it would appear that you are preparing to make a hasty departure.
Is that so? I'm thinking a change of scenery might be in order.
That is not necessary, Poe. All will be well.
With all respect.
I was shoving the last of my clothes into a burlap sack.
You're not the one those butchers will be coming after.
If you were to depart, I very likely would be, yes.
I said nothing in response to that, since he was correct.
Do you see me looking concerned?
No, then again, that could simply be because you don't realize the gravity of your situation.
Or perhaps you do not realize the situation is under control.
Look, three criminal henchmen are out there who would just as soon kill me as look at me, and they'll probably do both in short order. The only thing standing between me and a very imminent death is one fairly small old man, and somehow I'm seriously doubting.
I'd heard people scream before. I'd been present at some truly ghastly dealings of death. I'd heard and seen people go to their graves consumed by soul-sucking depression as they realized, instants before their demise, that no beatific afterlife awaited them, but rather only darkness and oblivion. That can be a most disheartening experience when you've been living your life in self-delusion as to what occurred at the end of it. But those screams were nothing like this. It was three voices I heard, and for an instant I thought the brigands had stormed out of Chimpan Alley's hut and begun slaughtering random villagers just to show them they were not to be trifled with. Just as quickly I realized that it was in fact the voices of those selfsame brutes, filled with screeching horror such as I'd never encountered. And considering I'd seen people die at the hands of everything from male harpies to evil shadow representations of myself, I had a fairly wide range of experience to choose from. And Double Chin's expression remained cool and inscrutable. The only change was the slightest twinge from the edges of his mouth. Otherwise, nothing. Then silence.
What the hell was that?
Double Chin said nothing. My consuming curiosity overwhelmed my normal sense of caution, and I hurried out of my hut. The villagers were standing about, and they bore that same distant, faintly amused expression that Double Chin had. Even the children looked that way, and on Kitchenette, I can assure you, it was a truly spooky sight. Whatever had just happened, it clearly came as no surprise to these people. All eyes were upon Ollie's hut. Perhaps they were content to simply stand there, but I was not. I hurried towards the hut as fast as my weak leg would allow me. I got to the beaded curtain entrance and pushed it aside, not caring about the clatter it made. Honestly, I didn't have the faintest idea what to expect. The bodies of all three of the bravos who had attempted to blackmail the village were strewn about the dirt floor. Their blood was seeping into the ground. Their torsos were in several neatly sliced sections. A butcher slaughtering oxen could not have done a more thorough job. Their heads were situated in various parts of the hut. Chimpan Ali was squarely in the middle of the hut. He seemed to have more possessions than anyone in the village, including a couple of trunks, some wicker furniture, some wall hangings. Nothing elaborate, but just an indicator that he'd been around long enough to accrue a few items. At that moment, he was sheathing a sword. I had never seen a sword quite like it. It was somewhat straighter than the swords wielded by the other men, back when they were in a condition to be a threat. But the handle was unique. Tinted light red, it was a carved representation of a bird, its head and beak forming the pommel, while its wings and feathered body insinuated themselves through the rest of the handle. Eerily, it reminded me of the phoenix. I had once encountered one of those gloriously mythic creatures and been subjected to a rather wild ride and the beginning of another unwanted adventure. Here it was again, looking at me like a silent carved reminder of achievement, or sins long past. Ali didn't appear to notice at first that I was there. Instead, he gently stroked the hilt, which I had to admit was disturbing enough image in and of itself. Then, slowly, he turned and stared in my direction. He tilted his head slightly. I backed out of the hut, turned, and saw the villagers slowly moving toward the hut. Only the men. The women and children were hanging back. In the uncanny silence, it was like watching ghosts of people moving through the real world without realization that they were dead. Except they were very much alive, and they were carrying burlap bags in assorted sizes. A handful smiled at me, as if we were having a chance encounter at the local market.
Do not dawdle.
Taekon Chin commanded his people, and they hastened to do his bidding. One by one, the men filed into the hut, and when each emerged, he would be carrying a sack that was bulging with what was obviously some body part of the former representatives of the Skanki crime family. On several of them, I saw large red patches forming from the pooling blood. They carried the sections off in the direction of the wheat fields, which I quickly surmised would serve as their burial place. These were resourceful people, accustomed to making the use of whatever they happened to have on hand, and decaying body parts would certainly provide as many nutrients to the soil as anything else they might choose to put down there. I don't remember going back to my hut. All I knew is that eventually I found myself there, seated on the ground, staring off into space. I could not believe what I had seen. It was like some sort of bizarre horror tale. Chimpan Ali was standing there, looking very unassuming and frail, and not at all capable of carving three men into fertilizer. He nodded to me in greeting. I said nothing. What was there to say?
You were brave, defending that girl. She might have died if not for you.
Well,
what do you seek?
What did I seek? What was there to seek? Whatever I found, it would invariably, at some point, rebound to my detriment. I just didn't see the point of it or the point of anything else, really.
Nothing. I seek nothing. I'm empty.
Good. Then you are ready to learn. Come to my hut tomorrow morning. You will learn the way of total destruction through inner peace.
Okay. When I entered Ali's hut the next morning, he was seated in the middle in a cross-legged position. His eyes were closed. He said nothing to me. With a mental shrug, I walked across the hut, eased myself onto the ground, and sat opposite him.
Why did you do that?
Sit down, you mean? Well, because you were seated.
Do you imitate all others?
No.
Then why imitate me?
Because you were here. It's your hut. You established how one is to behave within it. So I thought it was what you wanted.
And what did you want?
Truthfully, I want to know what I'm doing here. I don't understand it at all. I don't understand my life at all.
You think I can provide you understanding?
No, I think only I can provide that. I'm hoping that maybe you can tell me what I'm looking for.
You are looking for that which you are not looking for.
Thank you. That was very helpful.
No, it was not. Do you know why I said it?
No.
Would you like to?
Not especially, no.
You are a natural at this.
At what?
Ah.
He raised a finger and pointed at the sky. Then he lowered it and folded his hands into his lap. I was about ready to give up at that point.
What question would you most like the answer to?
How did you dispatch those men yesterday? 3 of them against the 1 of you. Bigger, stronger, 2 swords to your 1. And the way in which you did it, no matter how sharp your blade, there still has to be strength behind the thrusts. You cut through muscle, through bone, as if they were cheese. Yet you look...
unassuming?
Yes.
Helpless?
That's right.
But looks can be deceiving. You appear to be a lame fool. Have you not used that to your benefit in the past?
Yes, I've played to that, put people off guard. But play-acting is one thing. You killed those men. You reduced them to...
to nothing. They are now nothing.
Yes.
You walked here and made yourself as I was, seated, waiting. In order to reduce men to nothing, you must first be nothing yourself. When you have emptied yourself of all that you are, you can project that nothingness upon your opponent.
Well, won't that just result in both of us being dead?
No, because while you may be nothing, your opponent will be less than nothing. That is the essence of Zennihilation. Creating the total absence of your enemy by creating a total absence of self. Do you understand?
No.
Excellent. Stand. Hop on 1 foot.
I raised my right leg and proceeded to hop on the left one. Up and down, down and up, for what seemed an hour. He simply sat there and watched. I felt like a complete fool and was only glad that no one else was around to witness this absurdity.
Stop. Now switch.
Switch? I can't. My right leg, it's lame, you see it.
The weakness is in your mind.
No, the weakness is in my leg. It has been since birth.
And you would let yourself be limited by your body? Do you think I am limited by the body that you perceive?
I suppose not.
I was feeling less certain of this by the minute. Then again, I supposed, it was that lack of certainty I was supposed to be endeavoring to overcome.
No, obviously you're not limited.
Then hop on your right leg.
I switched in mid-hop, left leg to right, and was actually thrilled to discover that my lame leg supported my body weight for perhaps 2 seconds. I collapsed like a puppet severed of its strings. My staff fell to the ground a moment after I did.
What have you learned?
That you know nothing.
Excellent. You are an even faster student than I first believed. Sit. Cross your legs. A riddle. I never was, am always to be. No one ever saw me, nor ever will. And yet, I am the confidence of all to live and breathe on this terrestrial ball. What am I? You are thinking too much. You must meditate. You must relax and ponder the riddle. That is the fundamental concept of Zennihilation.
I thought we were going to train, that you would teach me how you handled those men so easily, how...
Master.
Pardon?
You will address me as master. That is the proper respect a student gives to his teacher.
I did not like the sound of that at all. It was not a word that would come easily off my tongue. But I was hooked, you see. Desperately consumed by curiosity and desire. Here was this frail old man, far more frail than I, yet he obviously knew techniques, secrets that made him virtually invincible. Once upon a time, I had been invincible. No one was able to defeat me in combat, and I was feared wherever I went. It was a good feeling. No. It was a great feeling. Granted, I did a lot of horrific and barbarous things during that time, and I regretted much of it. But I had spent my entire life up until that point feeling endlessly vulnerable to a world that was, for the most part, bigger and faster and stronger than I. I, apropos, limping along while the rest of humanity sprinted past. It was galling to live that way, and the exhilaration I felt during that time that I was Peace Lord of Woman was unequaled in my existence. The problem was, it was puissance that came with too high a price, and I'd had to divest myself of it. In fact, I still carry a scar on my chest from where I had done so. Since then, I had gone back to my previous and current form, and if it was frustrating before when I had to deal with my assortment of fragilities, how much more so was it having tasted indestructibility only to have it lost once more? But this man, this shriveled little man, he knew something, something that could make me, if not omnipotent once more, capable of defending myself with far greater confidence than I had before. And if I wanted that knowledge, I was going to have to play along.
Very well, Master.
And but you will not question me. The student never questions the master.
My patience was beyond wearing thin. It was becoming so threadbare as to let chill winds through without obstruction. This was getting ridiculous. As much as I wanted to be able to dispatch opponents the way he had, I did still have my pride. It was a tattered and pathetic thing, my pride, and really not all that fit for human company. But I had it nevertheless. It was at that point I decided that this was simply not going to work. I was just going to give up, and that was all. I would just go back to my hut or perhaps out into the fields to work, trying not to step upon freshly dug graves. And at the end of the day, go to sleep and hope that some clearer answer revealed itself on the morrow. And then I stopped. I blinked, my expression going slack.
Tomorrow.
Yes?
Tomorrow, I never was, am always to be. No one ever saw me, nor ever will, and yet I am the confidence of all to live and breathe on this terrestrial ball. The answer to the riddle is tomorrow.
Answer to the riddle is tomorrow what?
Tomorrow, Master.
Yes. You see, meditation leads you to be able to accomplish that which you did not know you could accomplish. To be able to rid yourself of all concerns. Once you find your core of inner peace, nothing can disturb you. All mistakes in combat stem from disruption of the spirit. With your spirit intact, you can be invincible.
Invincible? Well, I like the sound of that. Master.
I look back on that exchange now and am frankly somewhat mortified by it. That I would have so quickly, so willingly given myself over to Ali and his teachings would seem to fly in the face of the inveterate skeptic that I had always painted myself to be. I can offer you but one reasonable explanation, and indeed it is one that I have had to ponder long and hard to intuit. The most fundamental impulse of a man is to please his father. But for all of my early years, I had no father. Just an unknown bastard of a knight who had produced a bastard of a son. While I was growing up, the significant adult male in my life was an abusive tavern owner who employed my mother as a prostitute. Eventually, I did learn my father's identity, and during our fleeting time together, all I wanted to do was kill him. Hardly an ideal situation for male bonding. In short, I had never had a significant stable father-like individual in my life. And although Chimpan Ali at first exuded a gruffness and emotional distance, I also believed that he wanted me to succeed, that he was looking for someone to whom he could pass on his techniques and knowledge and considered me to be that person. I wanted more than I had. I wanted to be more than I was. My constant gnawing dissatisfaction was eating away at me like a cancer, and I believed that Ali might well be the cure. I got to my feet with my usual clumsiness.
Another riddle to consider until tomorrow. Why is a raven like a writing desk?
Because they both require quills to truly take wing.
Oh. All right. Come back tomorrow and I'll have another one for you.
I'll be here.
When I returned the next day, Chimpan Ali presented me with two handheld blocks, each of which had a rough, gritty texture on one side. They had straps on the back to make them easy to place on my hands. I held them up, studying them curiously.
What are they?
For sanding, smoothing down of surface.
All right, so what am I supposed to do with them?
Sand the floor.
Pardon?
Sand the floor. Make motions like this.
He swept his arms around in two semicircles.
You understand?
Well, yes, I understand the motions.
No, but no question. Show me sand the floor.
But it's a dirt floor.
No matter.
Master, I'm not exactly a carpenter, but even I know that sanding something usually involves wood.
Who is master here and who is student? Show me sand the floor.
It's a dirt floor.
Show!
So I sanded the dirt floor. It worked out about as well as you might expect. Dirt flew everywhere. I got it in my eyes, my lungs. This day, I think I still have some dirt beneath my fingernails. By the end of the day, the only parts of me that weren't covered in dirt were the parts where little channels of sweat had trickled down my skin. The only area of the floor I didn't touch was near his personal effects. I prepared to move some of them, such as his trunk, but he told me to leave them where they were. So I simply sanded around them. And all during that time, Ali, standing just outside the door so that none of the clouds of dirt would bother him, spoke of the various philosophies of Zen annihilation. He spoke of the two different techniques of meditation, Rinzai and Soko. He talked about containers and how I should envision myself as an empty cup, because only then could I be filled with knowledge. He discussed the beginnings of Zen annihilation, which apparently had their start with temple priests who allowed themselves to be subjected to incessant taunts and torments by soldiers, specifically so they could allow their focused rage to build to a point where they would be unstoppable. He spoke of many things, fools and kings. Ultimately, though, it all came back to the fact that I was sanding a goddamn dirt floor until every muscle in my body was aching and crying out for rest. Finally, he strode into the hut and stared at the floor, filled with hundreds upon hundreds of swirl marks.
All right, stand up.
Slowly, my body screaming in pain, I got to my feet, favoring my right leg even more than I usually did. I stared woefully at my dirt-encrusted clothes. All I could think about was throwing myself in the river to cleanse myself, and if I was really, really lucky, drown.
Now, you will instinctively be able to use the sand the floor technique to defend yourself against an attack.
I will.
Yes.
And then he was glaring at me. He drew back his fist, clearly ready to hit me. I did the first thing that came to mind. I brought the two sand blocks up, both still in my hands, and started smacking them together. Naturally, this caused a huge cloud of dirt to rise from between my hands. Chimpan Ali staggered back, trying to ward the dust off and not succeeding. He lurched out into the open air.
Is that what you had in mind, Master?
Yes, exactly. Very good.
I couldn't have been happier. All right, yes, I could have. I could have not been covered with soil and not aching in every joint. Aside from that, though, I was in relatively good spirits. Once more, we sat and meditated.
What is greater than the gods, more evil than the devil? The poor have it, the rich need it, and if you eat it, you'll die.
I thought about that one a good long time. I drifted deeper and deeper into my musings, letting my thoughts wander far afield, hoping that sooner or later they would drift back to the question at hand and I would eventually know it. Nothing seemed to be coming, however. Nothing at all. Nothing at... My eyes snapped open.
Nothing. Nothing is greater than the gods or more evil than the devil. The poor have nothing, as well I know, and the rich need nothing, and if you eat nothing, you will die.
Come back tomorrow.
And so it went, day after day. Every day riddles and lessons and various tasks and exercises he set me to. Unfortunately, none of them ever seemed to make any damn sense. He had me spend an entire day counting individual stalks of wheat. An entire night counting stars. One afternoon was passed quacking like a duck.
Quack.
A morning was consumed with seeing how many grains of rice I could fit in my navel. Once he had me water an entire field of brown rice by taking one mouthful at a time from a bucket and spinning it upon the grass. Then he had me sit and watch the water as the sun baked it out of the ground and it dissipated.
You must understand the transient nature of the water cycle, if you are to understand the transient nature of man.
Fortunately, I didn't understand either, so I had achieved some degree of consistency. And on it went, each task or challenge seeming more nonsensical than the one before. And while these went on, he would continue to talk to me about Zenihilation. How I could take down entire armies if properly trained. I would be able to break trees in half with one sweep of my hand. True Zenihilation masters, I was told, could levitate. I asked Ali if he could do so, and he said that he indeed could, but only when no one was watching. He assured me, though, that if I was a good and devout student, at some point in the future, I could not watch him do it. There was one time in particular when I felt as if I was simply not getting it, that the teachings of Ali were beyond my ability to grasp. I confessed to my teacher, while in the hut, that I could almost sense comprehension and enlightenment as if they were hiding just around a corner, tantalizing me.
You cannot obtain nothing if you strive for something.
But how could one achieve absolute nothingness? If one sets aside all concerns, all possessions, all self-awareness, all of it, then how can there be motivation to do anything? Rather than being able to harness nothingness, if someone achieved the level of no level at all, why would anyone care about anything enough to do anything about anything? Instead of saying, I will fight, it would be just as easy to say, I don't care.
Shh! You were going to speak of not caring. Do not do so. You are not ready.
I'm not.
That is the ultimate level. You have not come close to achieving it. When you do, then you will be able to master Zenihilation. Now, I want you to stick this wheat up your nose.
I know it sounds like madness, and yet for the first time in my life I had faith. Faith that it would all make sense. Faith that the pieces would come together for me sooner or later, and I would comprehend how it all related. Because Chimpan Ali was a good man. A good, decent man. A little strange, gods knew. But certainly there had to be some allowances made for the oddities that invariably accompanied advanced age. And here was the other thing. As I spent time day after day in training and learning and exploring the various ramifications of his annihilation, it left me precious little time to dwell on all the negatives that were so routine for me. My lameness of leg, my assorted failures, my burning frustrations all faded into a sort of distant haze of obscurity. I began to relax once more, my confidence grew, inner peace beckoned me, and I greeted it with open arms. I finally began to hope that everything was going to be all right. I should have known better, particularly the night when, after a long day of training, Chimpan Ali put his hand on my shoulder.
You have endured much, Po. In many ways, you are the son I never had.
Even as I grinned in appreciation, my inner voice, which had been speaking to me for quite some time owing to tremendous annoyance with my recent actions, piped up and said, "Well, that's it for him, you realize." I hate my inner voice. The night that I had dreaded for some time and then was foolish enough to stop dreading, which was naturally more than enough to bring it upon us, was an inclement affair. A storm had been brewing for the last few days. As the rain fell, I tried to imagine myself years from now, in exactly this same place. Would such a thing be possible? Could I truly wind up spending my life in this one small village? Certainly the villagers didn't seem averse to my continued residence there. Perhaps at some point in the distant future, I might actually come to think of this place as our village instead of their village. In the twilight moments before I fell asleep, I habitually flashed upon images in my life, which were typically distressing. This night, though, I saw myself quite old, perhaps as old as Ali himself. Children were ringed around me, listening intently to my every word as I imparted wisdom to them. They were smiling, and I couldn't help but smile in return. It was a charming image, and one that sent me gliding peacefully into slumber.
Ah.
I didn't know what time it was when I awoke. All I knew was there was trouble afoot. There were soft footfalls outside. I am not someone who wakens by degrees. I come to immediate and total awareness. It is a trait that has saved my life on more than one occasion. In the world in which I live, if one does not develop a talent for waking up instantly, one can chance waking up dead. Even in the darkness, I knew where my staff was. I never left it more than an arm's length away. Next to it was my sword. It was sitting out of the scabbard, for I had freshly oiled it earlier that evening. I was glad for that, lest the pulling of metal from its casing alert whoever might be out there. It was intruders. I was sure of it. I knew the comings and goings and schedules of the townspeople as well as I knew my own breathing patterns. This time of night, none of them were going to be out and about, which meant that someone who wasn't supposed to be here was here. Naturally, my first assumption was that more burly representatives of the Skankee family had arrived, that they would come looking for their missing fellow and not leave until they had found him, which quite possibly meant that they weren't going to be leaving ever if Ali had to end up doing to them what he'd already done to their predecessors. My first impulse was to hide. This was quickly followed by my second and third impulses, which were also to hide. Unfortunately, my hut was somewhat sparse in its furnishings, as were just about all the huts except Ali's. There was nowhere handy that I could secret myself. The slight sounds of splashing had tapered off, as if the intruders, realizing they were making noise, had ceased doing so. Had they stopped moving altogether, or were they so superbly trained that they were able to walk about lightly enough on sodden ground without giving themselves away? A figure peered in. Since it was dark outside and clouded over to boot, light was not plentiful, and the intruder's method of attire did not help matters. I was reasonably sure it was a female, based on the stunningly graceful way in which she moved. But she was dressed entirely in black, head to toe. I thought, although I could not be sure, that there was a sliver of open area around her eyes, giving her unobstructed sight. Other than that, though, not a square inch of her flesh was visible. She was of medium height and slender, and she eased herself into my room as intrusively as a ghost. Before the curtain closed, I caught the briefest glimpse of similarly clad figures moving about outside. Obviously, she wasn't alone. She had the hilt of a sword protruding from over her shoulder, indicating she had a sword strapped to her back. Of even more concern was that I was able to make out what appeared to be a dagger in her right hand. If she was coming toward me with that, I wasn't about to simply lie there and let her gut me in my sleep. She paused several feet away, afforded me a brief glance, looked around, and obviously didn't find what she was seeking. I remained still. With any luck, she'd be gone in no time. But then she took another look at me and stared more fixedly. Naturally, she would. The odds were that she'd never seen anyone or anything, for that matter, quite like me before. Silently, she approached. She then crouched down, tilting her head. Clearly, she was trying to get an even better look at me. It was really quite remarkable. Were I not looking right at her, albeit with a very narrow field of vision, I would not have known she was there at all. Her stealth was masterly. I found myself more interested in knowing where she'd learned to move like this than in discovering why she was here. And then, to my utter astonishment, she came in behind me and began to run her fingers along my body. I thought she was searching me for weapons at first, but no. She was probing my muscles, my flesh.
His face, effulgent, glowing, shining, unique in all the world in its singularity. I look upon it and my breast heaves, a soaring, crushing wave like the floating zephyr of an evening star. A woman's head upon a woman's breast is a woman placing her head upon her own breast to be one with herself and to know the soaring rapture of orgasmic release. But to look upon him is to look upon myself and see the strangeness and wonder that is within me, within all women, in all the secret places above and below the world, locked within our wombs like ripe bursting.
What the hell are you talking about?
It was not, in retrospect, the brightest way I could have handled the moment. Certainly I won no major points for subtlety. The woman was clearly a loon. If she'd gone on much longer, my gray matter would have begun leaking out of my ears. curiously, she didn't seem to care that I'd just revealed that I was awake, or that I'd had an impatient outburst thanks to her blather. Instead, she shoved me onto my back, straddled me, and began running her hands under my shirt. One would have thought I was still sporting that magic ring upon my member that had given me unparalleled control over the libidos of all females.
He speaks to me. His words like great waves crashing against the oozing sandiness of my shores. I feel in my breasts the current of liquid fire.
Right, that's enough of that.
I shoved her off of me as hard as I could, knocking her knife away. She landed on her back and then, to my amazement, scissored her legs about in a rapid circular motion that brought her immediately to her feet. I never even saw her hand move, but suddenly she was holding the sword she had pulled from the scabbard on her back.
Now, hold on. This isn't really necessary. I'm sure it's a misunderstanding.
His voice sings to me like a heavenly choir as my heart thuds, fair to bursting against the milky softness of my skin.
She brought her sword, slicing back and forth in the air in front of me.
I hear him, and the death of my beloved goldfish no longer touches me. To the birds! To the birds!
Well, that more or less settled it. She was completely demented. Unfortunately, she was a demented woman with a blade, and she charged at me with the grace of a shadow. I threw myself backward, hitting the ground flat on my back as her sword hissed through the air where I'd just been standing. I remembered the lessons of Chimpan Ali at that moment, grabbed up a handful of dirt from the floor, and threw it as hard as I could. The dirt took her square in the eyes just as she leaned in toward me to try and cut my throat. She staggered back and I was on my feet, bringing my sword about. How in the world she parried my thrust, I haven't the faintest idea. She was blinded, desperately trying to get the dirt out of her eyes, and yet no matter how quickly I tried to strike home with my sword, she deflected it. Quickly, I backed up. As I did so, I bent and scooped up my staff. She was blinking furiously, still trying to clear her eyes, still unable to see a damn thing, and I threw my sword against the bamboo wall. The sound was enough to distract her. She turned, sweeping her sword around, cutting at where she imagined I was. I lunged forward with my staff, even as she turned away from me. The sound of the blade sticking out of the carved dragon head snapped her attention back. But even she wasn't able to calculate quickly enough what angle I was coming in at, or what the sound pretended. So it was that even as she brought her sword up high, I thrust my walking staff from a safe distance and slashed across her torso. She reflexively bent over to clutch at the blood welling from around her shoulder, and I swung the staff around again. I cut it high across her face, barely missing the skin, but shredding some of the cloth on her mask, and she stumbled back.
My love, my hate, my sexual mate of fiery passion and passionate fire. I shall remember you even as I forget you.
She grabbed up a knife and turned and crashed through the door. I was about to follow her and suddenly realized that probably wouldn't be the brightest idea. She had friends with her, but then I just as quickly realized that she might well come back with them just to finish me off. If I stayed where I was in danger. And if I left, I was in danger. Better to be a running chicken than a sitting duck. I shoved my sword into my scabbard and strapped it across my back. Holding onto my walking staff, I slid sideways out the door and into the rain. The ground was thick with mud, the rain still coming down. Immediately, I lay flat on the muddy ground and rolled about in it as quietly as I could. It took almost no time at all for me to be covered from head to toe in mud. I even smeared my face with the stuff. Then, keeping flat to the ground, I flattened myself against the ground on the far side of the hut, keeping a view as to what this lunatic woman and her associates were up to. There was no movement. Nothing. All was silent. Silence is death. Then I heard the sounds all coming from Chimpan Ali's hut. My master, my teacher, the man who had befriended me and tried to bring me a measure of inner peace, even if he had chosen to do so in a rather bizarre manner, was in trouble. These black-clad women had singled him out. They were attacking him. And I lay there, unmoving, unwilling to push my luck against the women. I kept telling myself that my master did not need my help. These women, silent and deadly as they were, certainly could not prove a real threat against...
Where is it? Where is the Taki?
What is happening?
It sounded like Clef Chin, and he emerged from his hut.
What is going on out here?
Chimpan Ali is under attack!
This immediately caused all manner of ruckus, and within moments the entire village was roused. The black-clad women did not wait about to be discovered, however. They quickly emerged, a half dozen of them it seemed, although it was hard to be certain. They were looking about, clearly trying to figure out from which direction had come the shattered alarm that they were in Ali's hut. One of them, it seemed, looked directly at me. I didn't move, didn't breathe. Flat in the muck as I was not easily discernible under the best of circumstances, and these were certainly not those. Then they obviously decided that they had stayed as long as they dared. The problem was that these black-clad bitches would have no trouble laying waste to the entire population of the village if they were so inclined. But luckily for all concerned, they didn't have the stomach for it. They melted away into the shadows, although one of them was clutching her shoulder. I knew she was the one whom I had stabbed, and she was the last one to disappear into the darkness. She stared hard right in my direction, and I was certain she had spotted me. She made no motion of discovery, however, and within moments she too was gone as if never there. People were emerging from their huts and heading straight toward Ali's. With the attacking women departed, there was no reason for me to continue to hide other than my own natural cowardice. A strong incentive, I'll grant you, but moved by that point. I got to my feet, slipped once, righted myself, and moved towards Ali's hut with the rest of them. Villagers gave me confused glances, not recognizing me at first. I must have looked like a monster of muck having risen from the grave. The body of my mentor, my teacher, my friend, lay prostrate on the dirt floor that I had so meticulously sanded weeks earlier. His eyes were staring at nothing. I should have known. I should have been used to it. I should have expected it. I did expect it. It may sound like the height of selfishness that I looked upon the death of another and could only dwell upon how it affected me. Then again, I never claimed to be anything other than a selfish bastard. So what other reaction could reasonably be anticipated from me? The burning rage did not consume me immediately. It flared into existence deep in the pit of my stomach. But it did not come to instant full fruition. Instead, it nestled there, eating at me, stoking the already burning fires of my discontent. Everyone get back! Get back!
Now, see here! As leader of this...
I whirled on Taekon Chin. I said get back! I'm paying respects, damn it! They got back. I was alone in the hut. Well, alone except for a corpse. I simply stared at him for a good long time, wondering what it would be like to be able to bring him back to life through force of will. Then I noticed that his left hand was outstretched, as if he was reaching for something. Mentally, I followed the path from the tip of his hand toward where it was pointing. It seemed as if he'd been reaching for his trunk. The problem was, if there was something within he sought, it was pointless to have tried to obtain it, for the trunk was empty. The women in black had been thorough about that. Various of Ali's personal effects were scattered throughout the hut, and the trunk he was reaching toward with his dying grasp had been gone over more meticulously than just about anything else there. The contents were strewn all over, but the valuables tossed about weren't all that valuable. Old clothes, scrolls with writing upon them, I couldn't begin to decipher. Nothing else of value seemed to be anywhere about. Then I realized what was missing. The sword, that strange bird-headed sword he'd used, the one that he'd employed so handily to dispatch the thugs a seeming eternity ago. There was no sign of it. Was it possible the women had taken it with them? But I hadn't spotted it. They seemed empty-handed when they'd left.
Double chin!
He stuck his head in tentatively. I was remembering a word one of the women had said.
What is Itachi?
It is a type of blade, about this big, generally.
He displayed his hands in a way that indicated a blade about the length of the one I'd seen Ali use. A little over 2 feet in length.
Single-edged, very sharp, very deadly when wielded properly. Usually associated with high-ranking warriors and officials.
Fine, thank you. That's all I need to know. I gestured for him to depart. That was definitely the word I'd heard the women bandying about. Taki. Where is the Tachi, they had demanded. They'd been looking for the sword, and Ali had died rather than give it over. Or perhaps had died while trying to get to it. He'd been reaching for the trunk, Certainly the women must have seen it, which was why they concentrated so heavily upon the trunk in their search. A search that had been aborted thanks to the awakening of the village and the assortment of witnesses they obviously desired to avoid. But the trunk was empty. I went to it, studied it carefully. Yes, definitely an empty trunk. I felt around the bottom, hoping to discover some sort of place of concealment, perhaps a false bottom, something along those lines. Still, nothing. Then I remembered that when I'd been sanding the floor, Ali had told me to steer clear of the trunk. Not just the trunk itself, but the general area of the trunk. I stepped back, yanked hard on the trunk, and pulled it away from the floor, where it had rested. At first, all I saw was more dirt, but there seemed to be a variance in coverage. And then I noticed what appeared to be a piece of bamboo stuck in the ground. I knelt, brushed it away, and quickly uncovered exactly what I thought I was going to find. A small trapdoor. I lifted the bamboo trapdoor aside and instantly saw, there beneath the ground, a bundle wrapped in oilcloth. I reached down, gripped it firmly, and extracted it. I knew the moment I saw it that it was the Tashi sword. Delicately, almost reverently, I unwound the cloth until the blade was revealed. The sheath was next to it, both of them protected by the careful wrapping. I saw there was something else down in the small hole as well, and pulled it out. It was tethers to attach the scabbard to a belt. It was certainly a different manner of scabbard than I was accustomed to. Where I came from, the typical blade hung straight down at one's hip, if not being sported on the back. In this case, it was obvious that the sword was designed to hang in a horizontal manner. I saw the superiority in terms of style. It meant one could instantly pull out the sword in a sweeping sideways motion that was an offensive and defensive maneuver combined with the mere act of unsheathing the blade, as opposed to pulling out a broadsword in which you were leaving yourself fully exposed and vulnerable for a direct attack while you were getting yourself ready to bring your weapon into play. In such instances, you counted on your opponent's fundamentally chivalrous nature to allow you to prepare your weapon. In other words, you lived in a fool's paradise until such time as someone killed you for doing so. I held up the sword, snapped it through the air. It had a wonderful heft to it, so much lighter than my own sword. My bastard sword was designed to be utilized with one hand or two, but the one-hand approach was still a bit of a challenge just because of the sword's weight. The Tashi, by contrast, was so relatively weightless that it felt less like a weapon than it did a long, sharp extension of my own arm.
Pull!
I realized my time was minimal. I slid the sword into the sheath, rewrapped the entire thing in the oilcloth, and then shoved the bundle under my loose robed shirt. I managed to obscure most of it from direct view. Then I bent over and made my way out of the hut into the rain as the others looked upon me in various forms of bewilderment. What a sight I must have seemed to them. Covered with mud and muck, doubled over as I staggered from the hut that had, until recently, housed my teacher. I returned to my own hut, pulled off my mud-covered clothes, laid the sword flat near the far edge of the hut, and tossed filthy vestments atop them to obscure them from casual view. I didn't know why. All I knew was that I wanted the blade. I wanted it to be mine so I could feel a continued connection to Ali. So I could wield a blade that was capable of cutting down several men where they stood. Besides, those black-clad hell bitches had wanted it, had been willing to kill for it. That alone was enough for me to want to possess it. Which, when one thinks upon it in the cold light of years later, was a demented attitude for me to have. If something was that dangerous, traditionally, I would want to separate myself from it, put as much distance, preferably the width of a continent, between myself and something so desirable that there were those eager to kill the one who had it. But I was not thinking clearly at that time, for the aforementioned burning anger was beginning to swell ever hotter. Minutes later, with water gathered from the rain, I had washed myself off as best I could and was seated in clean clothes, cross-legged upon the floor. I had a small fire burning and was warming my hands in front of it. My thoughts were spinning.
Yes, what?
Double Chin entered, Lunch in beside him. Both were soaked from the rain, but neither seemed to notice or care. They bowed upon entering. From where I was seated, I gave a half-hearted bow in return. They settled to their knees opposite me.
Ali would have wanted you to celebrate his life, rather than to mourn his passing.
I tend to think Ali would have wanted to live, and the rest of it is a speculation designed to make us feel better. I saw one of his killers, a woman.
A woman?
Lung Chin looked apprehensively at her husband. It was purely a guess on my part, but I felt as if she suspected something already.
Yes, dressed in black. She came in here while looking for Ali. And she,
Did she try to take advantage of you sexually?
Yes, that's correct.
And as she did so, did she speak in an overwrought, emotionally driven manner involving similes and metaphors that made little to no sense? In an almost super real fashion?
Yes, how did you know? Do you know who these women are? You must. You couldn't have just guessed all that.
150 years ago, a group of monks fell out of favor with the Imperium. Himself a rather dyspeptic and vicious man, who abused his power terribly. Women, in particular, suffered his wrath, some in the most vicious and unthinkable ways. The Imperium feared the fighting skills of the monks, and came to believe court advisors who told them the monks posed a threat. So the Imperium set his deadliest and fiercest warriors upon them, and hounded them out of the heart of Chimpan. Eventually, they founded a monastery high in the mountain range known as the Aeneas. And there, in hiding, it became a place where women who feared the Imperium went to study, to learn self-defense, to become something other than victims.
Eventually, the monks died off, but more and more women came to the monastery, there to study and learn from those who had absorbed all the monks had to teach them. They expanded their studies beyond anything the monks could have dreamt of. They learned to draw strength from their passions, to use their sexuality as a source of power, and to celebrate that sexuality in a variety of ways.
And they became a warrior caste, shadow warriors, bursting with lust and tormentally twisted ways of expressing it. They meld with the darkness, wives of the moon, sisters of the silhouettes. They are the Aeneas ninjas.
And why would these Aeneas ninjas have an interest in killing my teacher?
I didn't truly expect them to have the answer. And as it turned out, I wasn't disappointed. They shrugged and shook their heads.
The important thing to remember is that Ali is with the ancestors now. He is truly honored.
He is truly dead, and the Aeneas ninjas will pay.
There is no point to vengeance.
There doesn't have to be a point. It's an end in itself. It's just... it's too much.
Too much?
You don't know. You can't know. You can't know.
Can't know what, Ho?
Me. What I've been through. These things. You have no idea of the life I've led. Every person I've ever loved has either been taken from me or betrayed me or tried to use me in some way for personal gain. Everything I've ever owned of any real value, ranging from treasure to friendship, has been lost to me.
Have you brought it on yourself?
Sometimes. Sometimes, yes. I have betrayed others. I have betrayed friends and let them down. I was responsible for the death of my best friend after stealing his fate. As much as I cry over the misfortunes that fall like shite-filled raindrops upon me, the truth is that I've brought it on myself. More often than not. Payment in full for the misdeeds I have done to others.
We didn't understand a word you just said. You spoke in your native tongue.
Oh, God.
How typical. One of the few times in my life I'd ever been honest, and my basic nature kicked in and made sure they wouldn't comprehend what I'd said. Well, who was I to argue with my basic nature?
No, I've never brought it on myself. Except that I've tried to live a good and decent life, and the world and the gods themselves have allied to prevent it.
There are some who are made to suffer.
I know, and I'm tired of being one of them. Yes, tired of being one of them, tired of loss, tired of... My mother was killed, the only creature on this planet who never betrayed me, and she was murdered by a heartless brute. And do you know what I wanted to do in retaliation? I wanted to hunt down, not the murderer, but the murderer's mother and kill her!
As an act of vengeance, it has a certain poetic justice to it.
It was cowardice, cowardice on my part.
It could be seen in that way.
I got to my feet, suddenly sensing that I was at a crossroads. But for once, it was not a crossroads that I was being propelled toward by outside forces, but instead striding toward myself.
Everything that I ever have is taken from me. Everyone I ever loved has been killed or left me, and I let it happen. Every damn time I let it happen, and I never do a damn thing about it. That's why it keeps happening.
I don't understand.
It keeps happening because the gods look down upon me and say, "Oh, look, there's Apropos. We can do anything we want to him, and he'll just take it and take it and take it." Well, no more. No more. I was on the verge of something with Ali. I'm not sure what it was, and now I'll never know. That's the real killer of it. I'll never know. And I'm sick of it. Sick of not knowing what it could have been. Sick of a life full of might-haves and just missed it. Those women, those Aeneas ninjas, took Ali from me, and they didn't just do it at random. They did it for someone, and they didn't just do it to Ali. They did it to me, and I'm not taking it anymore. Do you understand? It ends here and now. It ends today.
My head was pounding, and the veins were sticking out of the sides of my forehead. But I didn't care, because it felt good. It felt good to care about something so passionately that I could get myself so exercised.
What will you do, though, Paul? You are but one man. What can you possibly do?
Find them. Find them and kill them all. By morning, naturally, I had come to my senses. It was interesting to learn that I was still capable of such passion, of such fire, of such a staggeringly naive belief in ephemera like justice and fairness, that I was capable of feeling, even for a few moments, as if I wanted to do something personally to maintain such things. Except I wasn't. It wasn't that I was afraid of dying. Once I very much had been. So much so that it informed every single thing I did. But during my experiences in Muin, I had to come to something of an understanding, for want of a better term, in dealing with my own mortality. My innate cowardice had caused me to grab onto life so desperately that it had placed a stranglehold on every other aspect of my existence. Muin had loosened that stranglehold somewhat. However, there was still enough of the stubborn bastard in me that I was not prepared to simply throw my life away. That was the province of heroes. I had seen far too many heroes come to unfortunate ends, usually with very surprised expressions on their dying faces. So I had no interest in rushing headlong into a potential lethal situation simply for something as pointless as vengeance. Still, I had been utterly sincere when I'd spoken of seeking revenge in the name of Ali. One of the ways I had survived as long as I had was that I was something of a master of deception. The number of people I had fooled, lied to, outfoxed, outwitted, flim-flammed, and cheated was practically legion. Apparently, not being satisfied with fooling others, I had taken up the ultimate challenge, fooling myself. And temporarily, I had succeeded. I had convinced myself that I was ready to charge into the fray, to seek out the bitches who had killed my teacher and make them pay. That resolve had lasted for as long as it had taken me to stare long and hard at the ceiling of my hut as the rainstorm, with renewed energy, splattered away on the roof, and realized just how close I had come to being killed by that one woman. And that was just one of them. And I'd been damned lucky. If I went after the Aeneas ninja, I would not only be pressing my luck, I would practically be shoving it through the ground. The problem was, I had just made a great show of talking about vengeance to two of the chins. I had valiantly declared that I was going to dispose of the Aeneas ninjas. I had spoken great words. The problem with great words is that they have a habit of spreading. That night, mine spread faster than syphilis at a prostitute convention, and soon the whole village knew of my pledge. I couldn't just pretend that I hadn't said anything about it. I couldn't back out. They would all think me a coward. Not that I was normally especially worried over what people thought about me, but I couldn't quite bring myself to be dismissive of what the good people of House Bayou considered me. I liked them too much. They've been too good to me. I had spent my life letting down people. I was used to it. The thought of letting them down, however, was too much. Besides, they might be so annoyed that they turned against me, and I'd wake up one morning to find myself buried out in the wheat field.